What a day for a daydream. What a day for a daydreaming boy. And I'm lost in a daydream, dreaming about my bundle of joy. And even if time ain't really on my side, it's one of those days for taking a walk outside. I'm blowing the day to take a walk in the sun and follow my face on somebody's new mowed lawn. I've been having a sweet dream. I've been dreaming since I woke up today. It's starring me in my sweet dream, 'cause she's the one makes me feel this way. And even if time is passing me by a lot, I couldn't care less about the dues you say I got. Tomorrow I'll pay the dues for dropping my load, a pie in the face for being a sleepy bulldog. For a daydream, custom made for a daydreaming boy. I'm lost in a daydream, dreaming about my bundle of joy.
Well, at 4:30 this afternoon from the Cambridge Forum Series, we're going to hear from two speakers who disagree about the significance of tomorrow's elections. James Cheek has been a career diplomat in Latin America, and he's now an associate of the Center for International Affairs at Harvard. John McWard has led four congressional missions to Latin America. Whereas Cheek thinks that tomorrow's elections will be of profound importance, McWard feels that they will do nothing to resolve the conflicts and that they will only enable the United States to justify its support of a military dictatorship. More at 4:30. Tomorrow night, Independence Mall will be the site of an interfaith witness to stop the nuclear arms race. Cardinal Kroll has urged all Catholics in the Archdiocese to attend this candlelight ceremony. At 4 o'clock, I'll speak with William Grassi of the American Friends Service Committee, one of the organizers of the march. Also with us will be Toni Liversage. She's one of the speakers at tomorrow's march, and she's visiting America from Denmark. She's a founding member of No to Nuclear Weapons, the Denmark Peace Group, which organized the mass disarmament rally held in Copenhagen in 1981. Fresh Air's film critic Bill Van Wert will be with us at 3:30 to review the new Richard Pryor movie. Franz Müller was active in the resistance in his native Germany while Hitler was in power. He's now monitoring the activities of the European neo-Nazi groups. WUHY's Nick Peters will speak with him at about 3 o'clock. The Lovin' Spoonful was one of the most popular groups in the 1960s, and their string of hits included Daydream, Do You Believe in Magic, Summer in the City, Nashville Cats, You Didn't Have to Be So Nice. Well, with me is John Sebastian, who was the lead vocalist of the group, and you probably also know his voice from the theme song of the TV show Welcome Back, Kotter. Sebastian is currently living in Woodstock, New York, where he's working on a musical version of Charlotte's Web and also working on some cable television programs. For the last 7 years, he's done mostly solo concerts, and tonight he'll be doing a performance at Ripley's in Philadelphia on 6th and South Streets. And John Sebastian, welcome to Fresh Air. It's really a great pleasure to have you here, and I should mention that you have your guitar with you. And I'd love it if you'd open with a tune for us.
Well, okay, Terry, I think I'll maybe just do a little bit of a sort of a thumb-picking tune to warm up my fingers. It's still sort of early here in Philadelphia. Did you ever take a trip, baby, on the mobile line? I said, hey, Lordy Mama, hey, Lordy Papa, talking about the mobile line. Well, that's a road to ride to ease your troubling mind. I woke up this morning, baby, about a quarter, baby, about a quarter to quarter to four. I woke up this morning, baby, about a quarter to four. Yeah, when I got back, she was laying on the cooling bowl. Find your baby, find your baby. Your baby was gone. Did you ever wake up and find your baby gone? Well, that's a sure sign, honey, there's another mule kicking in your stall. Did you ever wake up with the bullfrogs on you? Bullfrogs on your mind. Did you ever wake up with the bullfrogs on your mind? Well, that's a sure sign, honey, there's bullfrogs on your mind. Timey tune for you.
That's great. That starts to answer the first thing I wanted to know, which is what kind of musical directions you've been heading in over the past few years.
Well, you know, I've always been hard put to answer those questions because I don't know that a musician's course of musical influence is very linear at all. Most people usually just sort of inhale all of this music that surrounds us. Modern people in the 80s, we can't help but hear both the most recent kind of thing that you might hear on the radio, as well as things from the archives that, according to what generation you're from, you've inevitably missed an enormous amount, and that the archivists of the world keep pushing that into our ears as well, so that I think that the opportunity is always there to just sort of expand out from a center. Songwriters in particular are, Mac Rabinack once said, I ain't as a great songwriter, man. I'm a great song kleptomaniac. And, you know, that's really, I think, what an awful lot of songwriters feel, which is that we're all just sort of inhaling whatever's around us, and eventually it becomes the compost that is the growth material for songs later. And very often, you don't know where you got something from.
Did it scare you when, who was it? It was George that was sued. No. He sued. Who sued who over My Sweet Lord? Someone said that was
okay,
a line
he so
from
fine.
He's So Fine. That's right. Did that scare you? Since I know that that's true, right? That people hear phrases and things just kind of come together. I'm not saying that
okay.
Most composers steal lines.
First of all, yeah, let me say that never for a moment have I ever thought that George Harrison consciously took He's So Fine and made My Sweet Lord out of it. The fact is that in the world of comparative musics, you can sit down and see this enormous similarity. You can see this enormous similarity between 90% of blues tunes written over 30 years. Yes, they're the same three chords in very many ways. It would be hard to say, you know, it's like the old conversation of do men have original thoughts, you know, and in some ways it's just a cumulative process. So it is a difficult area. I guess it didn't feel personally threatening to me because I'm also an old music fan, so I usually know when I'm stealing something and am real conscious of it at the stage at which something might be published. I mean, when you're just sitting around a room making up songs, you might discover that you'd rewritten the ship Titanic or something, you know, but...
So ever been anyone who you've been on the verge of suing because it came awfully close to one of your tunes?
Oh, no. On the contrary, I always am listening to the radio and hear a lick and say, oh, I just wrote that lick. Too bad. While I was writing this Charlotte's Web musical, suddenly I remember driving home and here was the Bellamy Brothers with a tune called Tangled Up in Charlotte's Web. And I went, oh, no. Now that means I can't write a tune called Charlotte's Web. But that was okay because some other tunes came out of that. Inevitably, trying to avoid something, you find a new route.
Have your loving fans forgiven you for not being a part of the Lovin' Spoonful anymore?
Oh, you mean forever and always and nearly posthumously? I think so. I don't think that too many people have wasted too much energy on that. The Lovin' Spoonful was a very exciting moment in time and period in my personal history and something that I have great affection for, but all the members are doing various things that either preclude music or are in another area, so it's always been very comfortable to me that the group went as far as it did. Cut it off before the grim, slow road down. We avoided all that, you know, playing amusement parks and smaller and smaller venues. So I'm very glad about the way that it all went, and I think that, you know, I can stand up and sing any song in the world and not feel bad about it, and I don't think that my fans... or the Lovin' Spoonful's fans have any confusion about the fact that this is simply what happened. I was raised in a musical circumstance, was very used to what it was like to be a musician. It was probably most natural that I would follow the logical course of remaining a musician past the spoonful. It's been that way for Steve Boone, who has had other jobs as engineers. He was the bass player, but he keeps his fingers in and keeps playing. In fact, we played a little bit recently at a show I did in Washington. Zal Yanofsky owns a wonderful and profitable restaurant in Kingston, Ontario. That makes it much more difficult for him to think in terms of doing any kind of long-term planning about a group, you know. Joe Butler is in New York working either in musicals, small parts, but he doesn't play drums very often. So it's all very logical, really, and I think I am forgiven.
Can you do another tune for us?
Well, sure. Let's see. Let me try to think of one here. I guess I'll play a song that is more or less a tune about somebody that is in my past, and probably everybody has one in their past. She's a lady, and I chanced to meet her in my scuffling days. She's a lady, hypnotized me there that day. I came to play in my usual way. Hey, floating along with a whimsical twinkling in her strange green eyes. Linger with me, she said yes, and oh, the time did fly. She's a lady, give her time, for she's allowed to change her mind. She's a lady, happy to say she once was mine. Only sometime I remember old times. And when she says, can you guess, it's a dress you won't believe. Would you come zip me up and button up my sleeve? Lady of ladies, I remember days that felt like it was raining daisies. It's for European women everywhere.
It's interesting doing solo concerts with an acoustic guitar hooked up to an amplifier. It's uncommon, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. And I guess a lot of people, it's funny, over the years, an awful lot of people who review my concerts come away thinking that they've heard an acoustic guitar. But what this is an acoustic guitar that has a couple of pickups in it. It's 10 years old, but it has a warmer sound than I seem to be able to get from either an electric, simply electric guitar, or an acoustic guitar with a microphone, which has inherent problems, or an acoustic guitar with what they call transducers, which are the small little dots that are put very often underneath bridges and reproduce sound in a very simple way that is a little mechanical, kind of brackish. So I'm fascinated with guitar technology and making instruments. I ended up building a baritone guitar at Veillette Citron in Kingston, New York, which is now actually on the market. So guitars in general have been a source of fascination. I started out as a classical guitar maker's apprentice when I was about 17 or 18. I was going to college all morning, and in the afternoon I'd end up in the sawdust sanding away.
Well, your father is a classical harmonica player, a harmonicist? What would you say?
You know, that's been a constant question in my mind. I always call him a harmonica virtuoso because there really was nobody that could touch him. Magnificent player and interpreter of classical music, and also a wonderful composer. He never gave himself much credit for that, but to my mind, some of his real hits were things that he'd write little 4 and 5 minute pieces.
You don't know any of them on guitar, do you?
Well, no, and I probably couldn't do them justice either.
Sure. I don't know how well a harmonica piece would translate to a guitar. Were you expected to become a classical musician and follow in his footsteps?
No, bless his heart. There was never any expectation along those lines. I think it's one of the things that hooked me on music permanently. The fact that I never received any pressure about how or what I should play or if I should play. I think he was exposed as a part of his Italian upbringing with a lot of young sons who were expected to become lawyers or doctors or hardware store owners like their fathers, and it obviously rubbed him the wrong way, and he simply made me understand that I had an even greater responsibility than simply following in somebody's footsteps, that I had to follow my own path and meet life on my own terms. I think it was one of the things that made music very seductive, that there was no pressure.
Nevertheless, when you became the leader of a very successful rock band, well, people have always suspected that terrible things go on in rock bands, and I think, you know, parents always are particularly nervous about what their child is doing when they're in the world of music. Did they panic about that?
Well, I think my parents, first of all, I have to give credit to two fairly urbane and, after all, West Village, New York types who were fully into music. It didn't end in writing. My mother's a writer and had written scripts and so on, went on to do historical novels. So the situation was that they'd pretty much seen all the horrible things that maybe somebody in Duluth might worry about. They'd been up pretty close to it, and I think knew it more realistically than maybe somebody growing up in a 9-to-5 job. The idea of staying out till 3 a.m. with, a bunch of people from a ballet troupe might sound a little bit too mysterious to deal with, but in my family it was a little bit easier than that. But I think my folks did worry moderately when I was suddenly at the center of this wild new rock and roll culture. But it really, I think, in the long run, after they saw that there was a degree of success and a degree of somehow it was logical that I should be there. And I think they saw that I had been a part of this nascent scene in the village. And as it grew, I was there. And so it was maybe a little more organic than simply writing a hit song and being in the midst of something that was very different than your life back home.
Did you ever worry about yourself being in the center of it?
Never. Not for a minute.
Because, you know, it seems that so many people come out with almost like confessionals years after something happened, talking about the terrible pressures, you know, that are on you when you're so much at the center of attention, and when you have all these fans who have expectations of what you really like, and what you really like might not coincide with that. And then, of course, there's all the monetary pressures, too, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, but there's also the fact that I guess growing up in this situation as I had, that I knew that fame is a thing that doesn't necessarily relate to how good you are. All it is a point in time, and it can just be a matter of fashion or out of fashion. And I've lived both ways, and I've lived in fashion, I've lived out of fashion, and so I think that It makes one a little bit more comfortable with the fame when it's there and the obscurity when that's there.
What are the trade-offs in personal life of living in fame and living in less fame?
Well, you see, you never have to go to the laundromat, and you don't have to drive. There's always people driving you everywhere and all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, you never get to talk to your dry cleaner and really get those stains out the way you want them. It's sort of, you get one step removed from the personal aspects of your life in some ways. It can be detrimental. I've heard a couple of people be very articulate on this subject. I remember reading an article by Marianne Faithfull in which she described the fact that at a certain age she had to learn to take her clothes to the dry cleaners. That she'd never had to do that, surrounded by the rock and roll business.
Yeah.
So the trade-offs are fairly straightforward, and you if you're anywhere close to conscious, you're seeing them at every minute. You
know. Let's talk a little bit about the music industry. You've been in it for enough years to know about the changes
from
the inside.
I've been in of it. I've been out of it. I've been in it again. I have.
Let's start with radio. What do you think are some of the striking changes in radio and radio formats and the way that records get broken and the what's in fashion and what's not? Is it any easier or harder now, do you think, to get on radio?
Well, as I'm sure you're aware, it's hard just to get a microphone and talk over the air nowadays because so much of it is controlled by computers. So much radio time is pre-programmed to the point where there really hardly isn't time for a given disc jockey or commentator to say two words outside of the things that come written on little pieces of paper that you get handed. The sort of wildcat aspects that existed, especially before my time and had begun to fade, then had a resurgence with this new music. Suddenly, with the advent of the early 60s, I think radio picked up after a period of, boy, playing a lot of, Frankie Avalon, Annette Funicello kind of a... there was a period when, and this is certainly not an original thought, this has been spoken about in endless books about music, how there was this stagnant period, and out of that, the 60s music really had something to push against to individualize itself somehow. Then I think that... there was a wonderful period in radio in general where there was a fairly wide scope that was being handled. It began to narrow again. I think now we're in the same place. We're in the Frankie Avalon place again, where everything is sort of pre-planned, and it's very hard to say, look, here is the weirdest record I ever heard by the Nerds from Akron, and I'd really like you to hear this, even though no program director told me to play this. Nobody handed me $18,000 in a small suitcase. I just want to play this for the fun of it. And that rarely happens. For example, people used to go snuffling around and look at B-sides and see what they could hear on the backsides of famous records, and you know, wonderful things were discovered. I mean, whole lot of shaking going on started off as a B-side, you know? So there are things to be discovered that we're missing in this modern radio format. It's wonderful, for example, to be able to talk to you for 15 minutes at a shot and not have to stop while somebody sells car paint.
What about the record industry? What are some of the changes you see there?
Well, those are probably even more exaggerated, the differences. When the Spoonful started out, for example, records simply didn't sell nearly as much as they do now. People remember the Spoonful hits and say, gee, that must have been a gold record. But of course, it wasn't a gold record. It was 600,000 copies, which was immense in those times and would put you in the top 10. Nowadays, we're talking about much bigger figures when we talk about hit records or hit albums. Equipment was so vastly different. I mean, I remember going into enormous stadiums with, this is for all of you techies out there, you know, what two Shure columns are. That's just a brand name for two columns that stood about 6 feet high, were about 3/4 of a foot wide, and had six 10-inch speakers in them. And this was the sound system for a stadium. The technology that came to the aid of the rock musician and the rock promoter and the rock entrepreneur to present this music quadrupled every 6 months in output. The Spoonful used to play, for example, without monitors. That's unheard of now. People work with a monitor system no matter what.
Did you have a lot of PR working for you when you were...
Well, not nearly as much as, say, some of the West Coast groups like the Byrds. We always felt kind of like the New York City underdogs that were making it on pure hard time logged in a club, as opposed to having a tremendous hot publicity staff. After the Spoonful had had a hit or two, I was really happy. We had a man named Dan Moriarty who... continues to be a genius in that field and also a wonderful character and somebody who was able to pick up on this essential shabbiness that was the Spoonful. There was something small time about us at the same time that we were having the success, and I think that he appreciated it the same way that we did and in some ways was able to bring it out in press. So we had a good press man after a year or two for about a year or two.
How did you break into the radio the first time? Do you remember how that happened?
Oh, wrote a hit record.
How did it become the hit?
First of all, I took it around to every major record company in New York City and got turned down because it didn't sound like anything that they'd heard before. Then we stood around and played it at the Night Owl Cafe for 6 months until Phil Spector came down one night, put his ear to the wall, and by 24 hours later, anybody from 1650 Broadway was down in the Night Owl because they'd heard that Phil Spector was there. So sometimes it just takes something like a guy with an original thought to start off the ball rolling, and from then on, suddenly we were persona grata in the New York music business. Whereas the night before, we'd just been those guys who play weird things and don't sound like Frankie Avalon.
Which of your songs are...
By the way, Frankie, yeah. I really hate to be laying on you. I'm just using you as an example. I'll be this example to somebody else someday, so I'll have to take the same verbal punishment. Could have been, Joey D or somebody.
Do you have favorites of the songs that you've written?
Well, the first one, Do You Believe in Magic, is particularly... I guess I have an affection for that because it was the first, and the first one that you hear on the radio has a certain weight, and then always your most recent tune is your, for me, that's always my other favorite, and that's something that isn't even published yet.
So I certainly won't ask you to perform it.
It's a piano tune. I couldn't do it, actually.
Can you do another tune for us?
Yeah. Let me see. What could I do here? I just discovered?
What?
I wasn't on. See, these are some of the problems, folks. Here's a tune that's sort of about people who don't speak English, so I'm sending this out to anybody who doesn't speak English, even if you don't understand. Ce n'est pas important si tu ne parles pas français. Ce n'est pas important si tu ne parles pas anglais. Je m'en fous pas mal. On communique quand même. I don't even care if we don't speak the same. I don't even care if we don't speak the same. Why should I care at all? We
ba 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 ba.
That's sort of a song that's still in the middle of being created.
That's nice.
We'll know what that whole song is someday when we finish it.
I like it. Do you see yourself as being in the like Tin Pan Alley tradition at all?
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm a songwriter. I'm one of those guys that can be embarrassing. Can really stand around there and actually try to write a song. Oh God, what a horrible thought. You know, I mean, not even waiting for the bolt of lightning to hit, to actually go into a room and lock yourself up and say, okay, now I'm going to write a song. So that really is the difference. I really luxuriated in the couple of years where I just simply would wait for a song to hit and write that down, and it usually took 15 minutes, and then I'd make more money than anybody who worked every day for a living. Now it's not that way. Now I actually have to go in someplace and lock up, and then once every now and then you get one of those nice thunderbolts, and those are usually the ones that'll buy you your house or something.
I love to watch the Hollywood films about songwriters.
Oh, yeah.
Rodgers and Hart.
Come on, Larry. Now let's try that again. Go for the bridge. Yeah, I love those. I love those movies, too.
And Noel Coward apparently had songs come to him in flashes. I don't know. Which of your songs came in a flash?
Well, every one that sold a million.
Really?
Yeah, those are the ones. They come fast.
Oh, that's great. Let's talk about festivals a little bit. Let me just reintroduce you. John Sebastian is my guest. Do you have a few more minutes to
I do.
Stay? Great. You performed at Woodstock, which was, a real landmark in American culture and certainly in rock culture. What happened behind the scenes there? What was the atmosphere like? I'd say backstage, but I don't think there literally was a backstage. There was a back tent,
well, we called
I guess.
It that. Backstage was sort of a muddy area that that had a number of tents in it. I managed to take over one of those tents very fast because I arrived somewhat early and had already been living in a tent. So I told one of the luminaries backstage, well, listen, I'll sort of look out for this tent. And fine. So I moved in, and I had some of the only dry instruments there. They weren't mine because I hadn't come planning to play. I came strictly as an observer and was asked at the last minute because the stage was wet. There was danger of electrical shocks. And so they said, we need somebody to go up there with an acoustic guitar and play for the audience while we fix things. So I borrowed a guitar from Timmy Hardin. I went on in the clothes I was wearing and properly psychedelicized for the occasion as an audience member, not, I guess I do want to make it clear to all of my potential fans out there that it is not my habit to become psychedelicized or otherwise impaired to perform. That was a kind of a weekend where, as I say, I felt like a member of the audience, and that was the general drift of things that week. In retrospect, I think that I play an awful lot better and sing a lot better than I sang in that movie for that reason. I guess I got away with it in some ways because of the mood of the show itself, but I don't hold nearly the affection for Woodstock, the event, that some people think I do, because to me I look at it and go, that was just one of those days when you got stupid a little too fast and should have been aware that maybe somebody'd ask you to play or something. But it did come as a total surprise, and that's why I was unprepared.
There's all kinds of like Woodstock history revisions that get like every 5 years there's another revisionist.
Oh, it's like the estimate as to how many people were there, you know.
But it started off being this like great testament testimony to peace and life and beauty. And then in the recent years, books have been coming out about how it nearly ended in catastrophe. Like you said, you went on stage with an acoustic instrument because someone with an electric instrument might have gotten electrocuted. Here, the stage might have fallen down with the storm. What were your impressions at the time?
I kind of would like to take the opportunity to poo-poo any of these retrospectives because, sure, if you sit down and take something apart, I'm sure that you can find that almost any festival situation, which, after all, in some way or another, does jeopardize an enormous number of people. I think that the situation at Woodstock was always a little trepidatious, but people were coping with it. I think they were coping well. I never felt in jeopardy. I was fully ready to accept the mud and enjoy the mood of this enormous quantity of people all blitzed out in a field. There was something that was terrifically fun about it. I don't have any of the reverence that a lot of people carry for it as a moment in time. I think that anybody who puffs up and says, I played Woodstock, it doesn't matter at all, because the fact is that that was a show where the audience was the star. That's what was happening, was the audience. And the performances were all fairly slapdash, as they had to be, because here you'd schlepped into this strange, muddy mega city with an absolute disastrous circumstance, and everybody is sort of holding it by their fingertips to keep it from falling into the abyss. Instruments and amplifiers all over the stage, people trying to keep the last band, you know. Woodstock is where most people learned everything that they could go, now we're going to do the such and such pop festival, and boy, are we going to be well organized. And of course, these things came off, very many of them, like Nazi events. They were, you know, they were cold and there were so many people on security that nobody could penetrate backstage. And I remember at one point sitting with my wife saying, wait a minute, wasn't part of the fun of these rock festivals was who of your friends could really talk their way backstage, complete bull slinging and getting backstage, you know, and yes, I'm a member of the family. I have to report a death or something. They would tell the guys at the gate and suddenly be, and hey, it's somebody, you know, my old friend, my producer, my old guitar player from the last album, whoever would show up backstage and it would be a hilarious reunion. And here I got through the gates and the security and suddenly all that had gone. And, I think festivals took a turn for the serious, and it was not nearly as much fun.
As a performer, did the Altamont Festival make you nervous when someone got killed in the middle of the festival?
Well, first of all, I wasn't anywhere near the Altamont Festival. I was probably at some other festival having a jolly old time. So in some ways, to me, there was a trend that went along with the way the music was changing, the way the audiences inevitably had to change, the way the drug use was changing. I came up in an era of what is now termed soft drugs. We're talking about marijuana, hashish, and peripherally, and only on rare occasions, some form of psychedelic. By that time, powder drugs had become absolutely common, and the use of them by just about everybody was changing the moods of the audience and changing the nature of the music at the same time. So in some ways, I feel like I was spared an awful lot of the fear and grief created by some of those festivals that really took a morbid turn.
I think it would be really interesting for someone to go around talking to a lot of people who did psychedelics in the 60s and ask them...
can you find your car? And now, test of the week.
No, but, you know, ask them What effect it had, you know? Like, how they think they're different for having done it?
Well, I wouldn't be a good person to ask because I didn't do it that frequently. I just did it when there were 500,000 people waiting to see a show. See, you know.
Okay. Do you think the stadium concerts of today are can be traced back to the big festivals like Woodstock?
No, I guess in some ways, sure. Except they have better sound systems now.
The sound really was bad there, wasn't it, at Woodstock?
I guess so. I wasn't out in the audience, so I couldn't tell.
Right. You live in the town of Woodstock now.
Not to be confused with the site. Yes, right. I live near Woodstock, and it is a lovely and only slightly sleepy little town up in Upper New York State.
Is there, I hear various reports about it. Like, some people think it's, like, really lovely and there's wonderful people there. And then I hear sometimes, oh, it's gotten very commercialized, too much attention paid to it.
Oh, well, I think that maybe that both of those opinions are a little dated. There was a period when Bob Dylan and the Band and 80 million famous guys were all living there. So there would be this moment late in the evening at the various restaurants in and around Woodstock where everybody was deciding what was going to happen that night. And I remember, you see, I was sort of out of it at that point because I was a newcomer in town and I had passing friendship with most of the people that were living there. I knew Bob Dylan from very early days. We hadn't really seen each other in 10 years or so. So in some ways, I felt very disconnected. And somehow or another, these little musical clutches would go off into the woods to various places. And I was always trying to find them and say, gee, I would love to just play for an evening. So it was a bit precious during that period, through no real fault of the, not to say that Dylan or the Band or anything created this atmosphere. It's just that obviously when you're a celebrity and you're trying to maintain some degree of privacy, it means a certain amount of exclusion of people around you. So there was a period when it was sort of high density interest focused on that place. I think that what happened in the ensuing years was that as many of those people left, it sort of became just the normal little slightly financially depressed area that it had been before all of that happened. There is a certain amount of people coming up and going, wow, man, where was the festival? And you have to sort of explain that it isn't right there in town. And
Our listeners who don't listen much to records but do watch TV probably know your Welcome Back Cotter song the best. Those
true.
Of our listeners who watch TV more than listening to records. How did you get to do that?
Very straightforward. It's not a very exciting story, I'm afraid. But
I
had an
it.
Agent. The agent was talking to a producer who said, I'm looking for somebody like John Sebastian. And he said, well, I have John Sebastian. And so I met a very nice producer, funny, insulting New York guy. We started insulting each other within 5 minutes, got along just fine, and put together this. He gave me a 10-page synopsis, and I wrote the song from that.
A synopsis? That's great. A synopsis of what the
I think it was a synopsis of the first episode.
So the song could be more topical.
Yeah.
So what was it like to have that on TV all the time? That was a switch from what you were used to.
I was really surprised at the power of television.
Because everybody heard it, everybody knew it.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I was on my way out of a Warner Brothers contract at the time, and they suddenly heard this song on the radio and went, oh, not so fast. Not so fast.
Would you tell us about the Charlotte's Web musical you're working on?
I'd love to. This is a project that came to me through a producer by the name of Jared Redfield. He asked me to write music and lyrics for an adaptation of E.B. White's famous story, Charlotte's Web. I did most of the music and lyrics, and during that time, he started to realize that growing up in New York, I had a very dear friend of my father's, close enough friend that I regarded him as like an uncle, but he actually did become my godfather. And this man was the illustrator for Charlotte's Web. So in this very strange way, I ended up very close at 5 or 6 to the development of the book. I was actually seeing my Uncle Garth doing drawings of spiders with faces and crossing them out and saying, no, she doesn't look good with a face, and sending it off to E.B. White. And the letter comes back from E.B. White that, no, the face is wrong. Somehow it's too cartoony with a face. And as those listeners out there who have read Charlotte's Web know, she ended up as a spider without a sort of a cartoony face or anything. So I felt very close to this book, and the producer eventually sensed it and said, look, why don't you do the adaptation of the book to the play, and that way you can make the holes for your songs as well as write the songs, and that way they'll be in the right places. So this was a great vote of confidence for me, because nobody had ever, I was not tried and tested in that area. So it was very exciting to sort of lock up for 6 months and do an adaptation, an 85-page thing where the longest I'd written was 3 minutes, you know.
So what's the plans for it?
What's the...
The plans for it. Will it be produced?
It will be produced. Well, of course, I'm probably jinxing the whole project. Yes, we are at this point looking forward to having an opening in Connecticut this fall, and then segueing on to Broadway.
Good luck.
Thanks.
And you're doing a cable show also.
Yes, some gentlemen from California recently started a dialogue with me that was, I guess, the basis for a television show idea. Very simple, straightforward show of music and conversation that I hope to be able to do out of my living room, so I don't have to do too much more touring than I already do.
Great. What do you listen to now on the radio? Do you just listen to, and in records, do you just listen to what's around and try to catch what's in the air, or there are things you're really focusing on now?
Well, I really was focusing on I Know What Boys Like yesterday. I think that's pretty terrific. I'm just like a sponge. I listen to anything that comes on the radio. And I also listen to this rather old, dusty record collection of mine that includes an awful lot of old jug band tunes and sort of 30s era Ma Rainey and stuff like that, which was, I guess, really a lot of the inspiration for the original Spoonful sound. This old music that, in the era that I was growing up in, of commercial folk music, it was so much more attractive to me and a number of my friends to find some of these real antique recordings and find out what some of this great American music really sounded like in its original form.
Have you noticed on the radio that there's a bunch of radio stations that are focusing on music of different decades? Like there's one station that'll do like big band music of the 30s or the 50s, and another like rock hits.
Oh yeah, we're
50s,
getting real
60s.
Specific these days, aren't we?
Yeah, what do you think of that as a trend?
Well, I guess it's good in some ways, that in that somebody who has a real narrow taste in music can kind of hone right in on what they like and never deviate from it. But I kind of miss the sort of varied menu that less specific radio stations offered.
Yeah. Are you getting a lot of airplay on the 60s ones, the Spoonful records?
Yeah, my little royalty check went up this year a little bit. I noticed that, they're tweaking Summer in the City and sending those cards and letters.
Great. Well, I want to wish you luck with all the projects that you're working on, and I hope the Charlotte's Web musical is a great success.
Well, thank you very much. I'm really looking forward to that and continued concertizing, and especially in Europe, where I know my voice may be being heard at this very moment. So I hope that all of my European friends, both ones that I've made and ones that I still hope to make, will encourage the powers that be to allow me to tour in the part of the world that I love very much.
I know you have to get going, but I did you have time to play another tune? I know that you really are on your way. So.
Well, sure. I guess, let's see, what can we think of? Or what can I think of? That's the royal we, folks. We have the enormous complex of electrical sounds here. Have the engineer turn up the guitar. Let's see. Here's an old tune. This is one of the first tunes that I ever learned off a 30s record. And it was also about the first tune that the Spoonful ever did and the first one that we'd open a set with when we'd perform. Well, now, listen here, people, about to sing a song. I'm going to St. Louis and I won't be long, 'cause I'm wild about my lovin'. I like to have my fun. If you wanna be a girl of mine, you got to bring it with you when you come. Now my old cat, she swallowed a ball of yarn. When them kittens was born, they had sweaters on. Yes, I'm wild about my lovin', and I like to have my fun. If you wanna be a girl of mine, you got to bring it with you when you come. Sergeant Jones, chief of police, the women around here won't let me see no peace, 'cause I'm wild about my lovin' and I like to have my fun. If you wanna be a girl of mine, you got to bring it with you. Strangest ending I ever heard.
It sounded real good. I want to thank you, John Sebastian, so much for talking with us and for playing for us. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed our conversation.
John Sebastian has been visiting Philadelphia. He played here last night at Ripley's. And, well, thanks again for being with us. It's a couple of minutes to three, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. In just a few minutes, we're going to be hearing about a hotel that used to be this grand hotel, and it's kind of changing, and NPR's David Selvin lives across the street from it, and he did a documentary on it. But first, why don't we listen to a couple of Love and Spoonful records? Two tunes with John Sebastian and the Love and Spoonful. It's 3 minutes after three. This is 91 FM on WUHY in Philadelphia, and you're listening to Fresh Air. As you've probably heard, tomorrow night there's a very large anti-nuclear arms race rally planned for Independence Mall in Philadelphia. It's an interfaith march, and at 4 o'clock we'll be meeting one of the organizers of the march, William Grassi of the American Friends Service Committee. Also with me will be Toni Liversage, who will be one of the speakers at tomorrow night's march, and she's from the Danish peace movement. There's a number of European peace movement leaders who are visiting America now. She's one of them. And at 4:30 from the Cambridge Forum series, we're going to be hearing two different views on the meaning of the elections in El Salvador tomorrow. Bill Van Wert will be with us in about a half hour. He'll be reviewing the new Richard Pryor movie. Well, I had announced a little earlier that we'd be hearing from Franz Mueller, who was with the resistance in Germany during Hitler's period in power, but we will be unable to hear that today. We will be hearing it sometime next week or the following week. What we're going to hear is a documentary called The Woodner Hotel, produced by David Selvin, who lives right across the street from it in Washington, D.C. It's a hotel that's been through a lot of changes, and he's going to tell us about some of them.
This is NPR Journal from National Public Radio. Going home, I always tell the cab driver that I live right across the street from the Woodner. It saves having to explain. Cab drivers, just about everybody in Washington knows the Woodner. It's a very large apartment building in the northwest quadrant of the city. The neighborhood itself is called Mount Pleasant. The Woodner now has about 2,500 tenants. It had less than that when it first opened up around 1950, but then part of it was also a hotel. In fact, the Woodner was the most elegant place to stay in all of Washington. It no longer is. But then a lot of things have changed since the early 50s. Back then, a tankful of gas cost only about $3. Only a few people were watching TV. Les Paul was on the radio, and if you were black, you didn't stay at the Woodner. The country was segregated.
I can't eat.
Further down on 16th Street, Truman was out, Eisenhower was in the White House, and in the decade that followed, there was a kind of surplus in America that must have seemed inexhaustible. There was also a kind of serenity that probably didn't seem like the stillness before a storm. Dwight Eisenhower at the start of his second term.
I have today issued an executive order directing the use of troops under federal authority to aid in the execution of federal law at Little Rock, Arkansas.
An American soldier in Korea, 1952.
This affair is more than a police action. It's something gigantic.
The grandest and final of the grand openings was in honor of President Eisenhower's first inauguration. That was when the ship was finally launched.
During that inaugural, we had a group of Texans here. They didn't stable their horses here, but they had horses that they stabled out somewhere and rode in the parade. But they had whole suitcases full of silver, real silver dollars, and they threw those out during the parade and also used them for tipping purposes around the hotel, something that wouldn't be likely to see again.
Joseph McCarthy, the junior senator from Minnesota in the early 50s.
Deciding why we're losing to communism at this tremendous rate, why the sands in the hourglass of time are running out for Western civilization.
The tradesmen and the maids and all, we couldn't use the front entrance of the building.
When you walk in, you walk into a vast, really quite a wide terrazzo lobby with marble, pink marble columns. You'll recollect that pink and gray were certainly the national colors of America in the 50s. It was initially the class hotel, and it was the Watergate of its day, certainly. During that period of time, we had a number of very, very well-known people living here, and certainly some of them who kept this as a sort of a pied-à-terre in case they needed a place in town. A number of congressmen, senators, cabinet-level officials.
Richard Nixon's Checkers speech, 1956.
I own a 1950 Oldsmobile car. We have our furniture. We have no stocks and bonds of any type. We have no interest of any kind, direct or indirect, in any business.
35. The Watergate today, you know, that's what it was. Yes, very fancy place. Jenny Mansfield, as a matter of fact, I fixed her hair once. Another girl, she was Peters, what's her name? Roberta Peters, the opera star, she did. She was here. I fixed her hair.
Well, the best story of that whole lot is Jimmy Hoffa, who had two adjoining suites of rooms on the top floor, and the FBI had the two adjoining suites on either side of him, and used to sit listening on the wall with drinking glasses, that sort of thing. And in those days, of course, we didn't have dial telephones in the room. It all was switched through the switch